This week on Your Western Context, Alberta's Sovereignty Act gets a bit more clarity. BC's economic case for LNG has never been stronger, and global news lobbies for more government money. Also, Elizabeth May says she takes her marching orders from Palestine leadership. This is Western Context, episode 297, recorded Saturday, December 3rd, 2022. Marching orders. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are here as we are each and every week. And this week was a bit of an interesting week in the news media here in Canada, since it seemed to start out a little bit quieter. But in the end, we definitely wound up with some interesting stories.
Yes, indeed. And certainly quiet news weeks in Canada really just means that the news media is focusing on issues outside of Canada, especially in America, where there's always a hotbed of news activity. And it means that these news organizations that claim to serve Canadian interests generally just tend to ignore Canadian media stories and news that really matters to Canadians or should matter to Canadians, which is why we're here to really talk about those stories that the Canadian media has really not been covering, especially this past week.
Yeah, and what this lines up as being is a whole depth of stories from top to bottom, covering things that might make people raise eyebrows, to some things that should just make people absolutely shudder with what's been said this week. And of course, if you're joining us for the first time, Western Context is the podcast that aims to cut through media bias and sensationalism, and in doing so, we hope to provide all the information and context necessary to put you, our listeners, on the right side of the news. And we have full show notes available at westerncontext.ca, where you can follow along with all of our stories. You can also find there our fall 2022 listener survey, and we're doing this survey to gain a picture of what you guys want from Western Context, what you like, what you don't like, and maybe learn a little bit about our listeners. So if you would be so kind, please head on over to westerncontext.ca/fs and take our fall survey. All demographic info that we ask for is 100% optional, so you don't need to fill that in if you don't want to. And by filling it out, you greatly help us plan where the podcast goes over the next year. So once again, that's westerncontext.ca/fs. And we're going to start off with Alberta this week, because this Alberta story really has garnered a lot of attention across the entire country. And the interesting part about this, and one thing we always talk about here, is that the age-old rule of politics and vote buying in general is to follow the money. Now, it's for that reason that tabling Bill 1 is the Alberta Sovereignty Within a United Canada Act in the Alberta Legislature is raising many eyebrows, when the Premier and her government should be focused on issues of affordability and making that the thing that everybody is talking about from now until the next election. Now, of course, much of the story this week focused on the powers that the bill would grant. The bill, as written and as introduced into first reading in the legislature, would allow cabinet to amend laws without consulting the legislature. And it has been described as, both by myself and other columnists, as being an emergencies act for the Alberta government. You can take that how you want it. Now, the Premier, by Friday, has said that she'd be open to amendments to make it so that any laws that were changed by cabinet or brought forward would have to come back to the legislature for a vote. And that's the way it should be. That should put the issue to bed, because when people think about it, would they want a different government, an opposition government of any color in power in Alberta, using powers like this? Ask every supporter of Danielle Smith that you may or may not know whether they want this. Their answer would probably be probably not. So this is something that the government has said that they're willing to move on, and this was moving through the media late Thursday and into Friday as well. So this should be issue done on this, but it's not. The main issue at hand for most people, as I mentioned, is of course the affordability due to the closing and reopening of the economies in our country over the dark times of the past 2 years. Now, this was, of course, exacerbated here in Canada by the government at a federal level that spent too much money before those dark times, which in turn required the Bank of Canada to engage in quantitative easing. This effectively means that the central bank put money into the economy by purchasing raw assets from the government or just by purchasing bonds, thereby giving the government money to spend. This means throughout the better part of the last 7 years, the main blocking factor for Alberta was indeed the federal government. And while the Sovereignty Act puts Alberta on the path of acting more like Quebec, which is very, very interesting when you think about it, the narrative of affordability is lost, which turns out to be a loss for the provincial government. Now, the Alberta Sovereignty Within the United Canada Act is drawing fire for the reason above, but it should also be drawing fire for what the NDP, the Alberta NDP, feels about the bill. And this is where the story gets really interesting. When talking to the media this week, NDP leader Rachel Notley was asked, Justin Trudeau says that he is taking no option off the table. And they said he specifically didn't say that, but the question involved was whether or not the Prime Minister would revoke the act. Then the NDP leader was asked, what do you think that this would create as a situation if that were to be the case? And obviously that's a very, very obtuse question along the way. And in response to that, what she said is that the Trudeau government should do whatever they can in order to prevent this from becoming law in the province. And this should have been a simple answer to make for the NDP leader, in that the province should be left alone to make their own laws. And in particular, she said that I think if they revoke the act, that would be the right thing to do because it's a mess and they don't know what they're doing. And yes, that won't look good for this government either, but quite honestly, we're 6 months away from an election. Now, people might be wondering how exactly this can happen. Well, under sections 55 and 56 of the Constitution Act of 1867, a federal cabinet can disallow a law of a provincial legislature. And the interesting part about that is that the last time this was used was 1943. It's been used 112 times by the Government of Canada and once by the UK government going back to 1867. And when it was used in 1943, the federal government invalidated Alberta legislation that prevented the land sales to Hutterites and, quote, other enemy aliens. Now, this is, of course, here on display, the leader of the Alberta NDP suggesting that the Prime Minister should use this seldom-used tool to prevent the province from progressing forward at its own peril. And that's the key point there, at its own peril. Businesses, of course, have concerns regarding the Sovereignty Act, and businesses in general should be consulted, and even more so on legislation, especially whenever the economy is in question. And this is something that the Progressive Conservatives did well, and a lot of people in the province will offer you the conventional wisdom that the Progressive Conservatives ran the province well from 1974 to 2015, having been elected and then re-elected by pivoting to match the mood of the day of what the governing or what the population wanted, altering their governing points from conservative viewpoints to even centrist liberal standpoints at times. And what they mastered was knowing where the population was going and matching it. The UCP under Danielle Smith must hope that the voting population, specifically in Calgary, because we've discussed many times before here on the podcast that this next election is going to come down to what happens in Calgary. So with that, the voting population in Calgary need to feel the issues that are at hand in the province and in day-to-day life are the ones that are being tackled by the Alberta government, and we'll just have to wait and see if the Sovereignty Act falls into that category, or else there could be troubles for the governing UCP. Now, Premier Smith summed it up by saying, I think that maybe we have a little lack of clarity. We never intended for it to apply to statutes. Statutes do have to come back to the legislature for approval, and if there's any statutory change that we would have to make under this bill coming out of these motions, we'll make it clear that that is the case. Now, of course, this has set off a firestorm, and it shows why the people who support the Premier want this piece of legislation. We can also see it in the NDP leader's response and in Trudeau's response and in the media and, of course, in particular, what can only be described as the Laurentian elite as for the reason that the UCP government is bringing in this bill. There was, of course, a measured opinion piece in the Globe and Mail by Gary Mason, who hails from Vancouver, but that piece was shared by Eastern journalists, encouraging Albertans to instead vote out the UCP. There was even a CBC at issue panel where not a single one of the columnists or contributors was from west of Ontario, yet they were talking about how the Alberta government, and in particular the federal government, should handle Alberta. And this underscores specifically why Premier Smith and her supporters want the Alberta sovereignty within the United Canada Act. And we'll have to watch and see what happens with this as we head on closer to the May election. But one interesting thing that did come from this, and many people are saying that this is a sign that the Alberta Sovereignty Act is heading in the right direction, members of the Parti Québécois in Quebec have actually said that Quebec should be inspired by Alberta Sovereignty Act, which when you think about it, that's a very interesting thing, because people who live in the West and people in particular who live in Alberta might not see that the province has a great deal in similarity with Quebec, but in reality, Quebec has much of the same grievances with the federal government. They're just better at pushing back than Alberta was, and many people see the Alberta Sovereignty Act as heading in that direction, and that's what Premier Smith's supporters wanted, and it's clear from this also that's what the Parti Québécois wants, and as we see everybody else on the other side, Rachel Notley, Justin Trudeau, the mainstream media, and of course those columnists and reporters from out east talking about how to handle Alberta, maybe that's precisely what the doctor has ordered, but we'll have to wait and see if the voters of Calgary are on board with this and support the general direction that Premier Smith and the UCP are taking the province.
Yes, it's interesting looking into the Sovereignty Act a bit more and seeing what it actually does. And as you said, it is more akin to a provincial emergencies act, except in this particular case, the emergency isn't an actual emergency. It's more of incursions by the federal government. And a lot of Albertans could consider that to be an emergency as well, because the federal government, of course, has been very hostile to Albertan interests over the past decade, especially given their lack of support for any oil or any gas, natural resources, anything that would actually help Alberta be economically viable. It seems to be under attack by the federal government of Justin Trudeau. And certainly, the past has shown just how much the federal government is willing to go against Albertan interests. So for Alberta to put forward something that would help protect Alberta from these incursions into provincial rights, it's definitely something that could be seen coming for quite some time. And the only interesting thing is that it hadn't happened under a different premier. And I think that a lot of the news about the Sovereignty Act has really just been talking about worst case scenarios or almost doomsday sort of scenarios that will likely not come to pass. And it's interesting to see all the media rhetoric on this, because a lot of it is just going against it without really going into the details of what the Sovereignty Act actually is and how it could be used, rather than going off of these hypotheticals. It's interesting to show the similarities within Alberta and in Quebec, which has a provincial government that has long been able to champion Quebec's interests within the federal government for quite some time. And no matter which government it's been, whether it's the reigning CAQ right now, or the previous Parti Québécois, or even the provincial Liberals, it's interesting to see just how much the power that Quebec has had over the years, doing a very similar thing that Alberta is doing right now, just because of voting patterns and how the different federal governments get elected. So when it comes down to it, it's interesting to see a lot of people from back east trying to tell Albertans how they should be running their province, when likely they wouldn't even voluntarily step foot in the province and experience its wonders.
Yeah, that's typically the way it's given out. And a lot of the way the NDP seems to be running things these days is a lot of their criticism comes from social media, which they take on board, which then the media takes on board. And the question about being able to bypass the legislature on this was the main issue within the province this week, and that's done at this point. And, you know, we'll have to wait and see what happens in subsequent amendments and subsequent readings of this. But next door in Saskatchewan, the Saskatchewan First Act passed first reading with actually the NDP there supporting it. So we'll have to see if we can get to a point here in the province where the NDP will do that. And then that would actually send the message that Alberta is probably wanting to send on that. But of course, we won't put the cart before the horse on that. We do have to move on and talk about more natural resources in BC. But before we do that, I'll just take a moment and remind our listeners that you can support Western Context monetarily. If you so choose to, you can check us out on Patreon at patreon.com/Western Context there, starting for as little as $2 a month or the price of a cup of coffee. You can help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month, you can continue to help us do that and have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. Now, when we reach $30 a month in contributions, patrons will receive an exclusive monthly news article covering topical stories of the month. And when we reach $60 a month, you'll receive a special news and review podcast every other month, where we'll reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and talk about where things might be headed next. And we also do have an option to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, which you can learn more about at westerncontext.ca/support. So with that, we head on over to BC and talk about a huge missed opportunity for the province of BC, but also a huge missed opportunity for Alberta.
Yes, indeed. And BC's deal with LNG Canada to get the Coastal GasLink pipeline on board, and which would bring liquefied natural gas from northeastern BC over to the port in Kitimat on the west coast, which would be able to transform the natural gas into liquefied form, which could then be stored on tankers and shipped to anywhere in the Pacific. More specifically, could be going to places in Asia, such as Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Philippines, and many other island or pseudo-island nations that really don't have natural resources of their own. And this is the market that LNG Canada has been going for quite some time. Now, this deal was being criticized in leftist environmental publications this past week, like the Narwhal and the Tai'i, which were trying to dismiss BC's assertion that it will bring billions of dollars of revenue to the province. Now, back in 2018 and again in 2019, BC estimated that it would receive about $23 billion in government revenues over the 40-year lifespan of LNG Canada. Now, according to 2019 forecasts, those estimates include the upstream revenue, such as taxes, royalties, and hydro payments. And the province also predicted that the projects would create about 10,000 construction jobs and up to 950 permanent jobs at the liquefaction and the export facility. Now, the Narwhal contends that the net zero pledges that many countries have been making to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions have raised questions about whether global demand for gas will hold up over the project's lifespan. Now, currently, high natural gas prices, in part fueled by Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the resulting European energy crisis, means that there is incentive to complete Coastal GasLink and LNG Canada as quickly as possible. Now, an LNG Canada spokesperson said, quote, "As world events continue to demonstrate, a reliable supply of responsibly produced energy should never be taken for granted. Our project will provide security of supply for global markets that rely on Canada's natural gas reserves to fuel their economies, reduce global greenhouse gas emissions as natural gas replaces the use of coal, and brings significant economic growth and stability to northern British Columbia communities and all of Canada." Now, some experts admit that LNG Canada would be very profitable if it were running today, but have questions about if it would be profitable in 2025-2026, when it's estimated to be completed. Models from the International Energy Agency that predict a huge drop-off for energy demand by the 2030s and 2040s do take into account that countries will be holding to their net zero pledges. And if they do not, as is often the case, then it is pretty clear that there will still be a business case for natural gas, especially as a cheaper and environmentally friendly option than crude oil or even coal, which a lot of East Asian countries like China still use. Now, many LNG companies have been criticized in the media recently for reaping massive profits off the backs of an inflation crisis and then not reinvesting and instead just pocketing the extra cash for their shareholders. Now, on the contrary, it actually appears that increased demand for LNG has led both Canadian and U.S. producers to expand their operations. Now, Ian Archer, who is the Associate Director of Commodity Insights for S&P Global, said, quote, "This year's really been a banner year for gas development. We've seen very strong growth in Western Canadian production." Now, Enbridge recently announced that it plans to invest between $3.6 and $5.5 billion to expand its natural gas pipelines in BC. This suggests that the Montney Formation in northeastern BC, which is the location for most of these natural gas development, will continue to be a significant gas-producing region for decades and will continue to draw billions in investment thanks to new LNG projects expected to come online soon in BC as well as in the US. Now, Enbridge isn't the only midstream company with expansion plans. North River Midstream has applied to the CER for a new project, which is called the Northeast BC Connector, which is a 250-kilometer twin pipeline that would run from BC to Alberta. Now, that project is driven more by the natural gas liquids markets than LNG, but of course, one pipeline would be for condensate, which is a type of light oil used to dilute bitumen, and the other would be for other natural gas liquids. Now, according to the BC Oil and Gas Commission, there were 310 new wells drilled in BC in 2022, and drilling can be expected to ramp up over the next couple of years, provided that the BC government and Blueberry River First Nation, which is around the area that many of this natural gas development is in, can agree on land use issues in the region. Now, in fact, more of the problems from LNG in Western Canada may actually come from an unfriendly federal government than a lack of economic viability, which longtime listeners of the podcast will know that we've definitely talked about this unfriendly government practice that has been taking place over many, many years. Now, at the outset of 2022, it should be noted that Russia was meeting roughly 50% of Germany's natural gas needs. And when the Russian invasion of Ukraine left the Germans scrambling for alternate sources, the German chancellor was actually quite open about Canadian gas being their first choice. Olaf Scholz told a Toronto economic conference back in August that, quote, "As Germany is moving away from Russian energy at warp speed, Canada is our partner of choice. We hope that Canadian LNG will play a major role in this." Now, nevertheless, the German leaders and treaties were met largely with disinterest from the Canadian federal government. At a joint press conference with Olaf Scholz, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said openly that there is, quote, "never been a strong business case for Canadian LNG exports to Europe." Now, the Prime Minister then insisted on taking his German counterpart to Stephenville, Newfoundland, which is the site of a proposed facility to make hydrogen gas from wind power. Now, with any groundbreaking still years away and with hydrogen still a vanishingly small piece of Germany's energy mix, the visit didn't appear to yield any particular German enthusiasm for Canadian hydrogen. And now, after an energy-hungry Germany was snubbed by Canada, Berlin has now gone all in on a gas contract with Qatar, which, of course, many people will know in the news as the small autocratic nation which is currently hosting the World Cup. Now, this week, German firms announced a 15-year contract to buy roughly 2 million tons of LNG per year of Qatari natural gas. Now, the multi-billion-dollar deal comes just 3 months after Olaf Scholz made the rare official visit to Canada for the explicit goal of securing Canadian sources of liquefied natural gas. Now, on Thursday, Jonathan Wilkinson, who is the federal energy minister and previously environment minister, told the House of Commons Natural Resources Committee that there's only a 3-year window for Canada on natural gas, and then Europe will begin pivoting to hydrogen, which is something that Canada is very interested in supplying to Germany, as he said. Now, contradicting Wilkinson, Germany's contract for Qatari gas begins in 2026, which is coincidentally the year that the LNG Canada pipeline is meant to be starting operations, going from the northeastern BC over to the west coast. So this means that tankers of Qatari gas will be sailing into German ports until at least 2041, and the scope and longevity of the contract would seem to defy Trudeau government claims that German gas demands were merely a temporary stopgap that carried no long-term opportunity for Canada. Now, in a press conference touting the German deal, Qatari's Minister of Energy, Saad Al-Kaabi, boasted about the long-term nature of the agreement and assured the Germans that Qatar could guarantee their long-term energy security. Now, while Canada currently has no LNG export facilities on its Atlantic coast, it would be more than feasible for Canada to fast-track at least a couple by 2026. Natural Resources Canada has already received applications for 5 different proposed Atlantic Coast LNG terminals, 2 in Quebec and 3 in Nova Scotia. This includes the stalled $8 billion Goldboro LNG project, which could be completed on a particularly accelerated timeline given new plans to build the facility on a floating barge. Now, in recent months, the owners of St. John LNG, which is a New Brunswick import terminal, have similarly raised the prospect of retrofitting their facility for export as early as 2025. In June, this idea was publicly championed by New Brunswick Premier Blaine Higgs. Now, as for BC's economic reality, it was noted 2 weeks ago on Western Context that BC ran a surplus in large part due to an increase in natural gas royalties. And clearly, the world still wants LNG in the future, given Germany's deal with Qatar, which runs into the 2040s. Now, Canada needs to stop shooting itself in the foot on natural resource projects, as the world will not care about our lead by example approach on climate change. And for evidence of this, we just have to look to Qatar. You should look into the history of Qatar and what they were able to accomplish over just a few decades, just with how they're able to be running the World Cup nowadays. Now, their meteoric rise to power since the 1990s, purely from LNG extraction and then being able to reinvest those profits into other entities like Al Jazeera and Qatar Airways, has shown just what a country can accomplish on the world stage if they manage their resources properly. Now, a reduced economic capacity has shown that this only reduces our influence on the world stage. And if Canada really wants to help fight climate change, then exporting our LNG and oil with its higher environmental standards to displace autocratic countries' supplies is a start. We have to start with fixing Canada first, and our economic reality shows that we cannot continue to rely on the world to help us out.
And the key point there is that Canada is not an autocratic nation with poor human rights records. That's point number one. And that's one thing that should make us attractive. And that's probably why the German chancellor came here. And it's almost as though the German chancellor did his homework before he came here and knew that there would be that new project coming online in 2026, which is when they would have wanted the LNG for. And as a result of that, why not ask Canada, given of course, the turbulent world that we live in? And as a result, instead, we see that same pattern of behavior, the same reason the Alberta Sovereignty Act is happening, that there is that hostile stance from the federal government on anything natural resources related, unless it fits into the virtue signaling guidelines of what the ministries of environment and natural resources want to do at this point of the game. And as a result of that, that's very short-sighted, since, of course, we're talking about Germany here, but there's other nations in Europe and Africa that are currently burning coal that might look to moving to natural gas. There's also countries out there that are much poorer that are currently, in some places, burning animal dung. And as a result of that, those countries in the future will be looking to move to coal. And after that, looking to move to LNG. And that is not something that's going to be disappearing in the next 5 or 10 years or even 15 years. And that's more than enough time to fast track these projects and get them moving. And that's one thing the dark times of the past few years has shown, is that there is an ability in countries to get things moving at warp speed when they need to. There just needs to be the leadership and the will to make that happen. And we're not seeing that here.
Yes, and I think that that's something that shouldn't be understated, because quite clearly, Germany was willing to come to Canada and, you know, making a very rare visit for the explicit plea for help and to try and displace Russian oil and gas from Europe. And this is something that could have happened a long time ago. And if our federal government was willing to help these natural resources along, we could have had pipelines that were spanning the country, not just going from Alberta to the U.S. or going from eastern B.C. and Alberta over to the West Coast. We could have had pipelines that span into our population centers in Ontario and Quebec and to export facilities along the East Coast, which meant that Canada would be able to export our resources to much greater demanding countries all across the Atlantic. And that's something that cannot be understated, is that if Canada had the option there, or even the willingness to be able to support these projects, Germany might have gone with us as a partner going forward. And that's something that Western democratic countries generally want to do, is they want to stick with stable countries. And given the fact that these deal with the Qatari oil companies is not coming online until 2026, clearly there could have been a case there for Canada to make that we could have supplied that natural gas. But because Trudeau was very dismissive of the result and saying that there was no business case, means that Germans had to go elsewhere. And certainly every other Western European country is going to look at what the Germans did and see that, well, there's not really much point in coming to Canada, because clearly Canada doesn't want to help them out. And they're saying all these things about hydrogen, which, of course, on its outset is a good idea. But in the meantime, you still need to export LNG. And a lot of these countries need to have a resource now rather than later on. So certainly this is a baffling decision by the federal government. And when it first happened, we definitely talked about it. And to see continued publications in BC contending the reasoning for the LNG Canada to even exist, it's just baffling, seeing that they're saying that there's no business case when there is quite clearly a business case, and that there is a lot of money to be had, and a lot of money that could enrich not only BC, not only Western Canada, but the entirety of Canada. And that's something that it's interesting to see this in the media this week, especially given the fact that there is this deal that was made between Germany and Qatar that nobody seemed to talk about. And I think that's something that really went missed in the mainstream media this week.
Yeah, and you know, we're seeing it with LNG here. It's people initially thought it was just Alberta the federal government was ganging up on. The whipping boy was, of course, the oil sands that are always portrayed as dirty and whatnot. But in reality here, we can see it's pretty much any petrochemical project. And it's something that's a story that's not told by the media and is not going to be told by the media if our next story comes to fruition. And the next headline is that Global News has been lobbying the Canadian government for taxpayer grants, believe it or not. And most Canadians, of course, will know that the CBC is run as a crown corporation and receives government funding. And throughout the Trudeau administration, we've seen that media outlets outside of TV and radio have received money from the government as well. Now, new this week, though, is that we have news that Corus Entertainment, that is the parent of Global News and many other TV outlets and radio stations across the country, is seeking government grants to subsidize employee pay. Yes, they're looking for government money to subsidize employee pay, where if this were an American company, well, they'd go belly up. Now, the news is only being reported in Blacklock's Reporter and the Western Standard, And because of this, it should raise many eyebrows in that it's not being reported in the actual Canadian media, who is, at least in a very large chunk of it, owned by Corus. And we need to be very clear here that this is not a partisan issue. This is not something that is liberal versus conservative, blue versus red. This is an issue about the media landscape in our country that we're talking about right now. And this would be the same story if it were a conservative government doing this or an NDP government. And the reason we're saying this is that there was a statement given to the House of Commons Finance Committee from Corus that says that unlike other Canadian news and broadcast content, Canadian broadcast news is not entitled to ongoing direct financial support from the federal government. And with this, Corus urges the federal government to, quote, readdress this inequity. Now, looking at the 2019 Income Tax Act, this provided a 25% payroll rebate up to a maximum of $13,750 per employee in a newsroom. So news agencies are already getting that to make paying their employees easier. Global News annual report also shows increasing, or rather shrinking, profit margins to 38% in TV and 15% in radio. They're also facing a libel lawsuit after Canadian Armed Forces veteran James Topp sued the company for an article implying he was a white supremacist. And, of course, discussion about Global receiving more money and more money in general has been going back and forth since September, when Global News Executive Vice President Troy Reeb told a different government committee, specifically the Senate Transport and Communications Committee, that, in his own words, news is a challenging business. Traditionally, we have offset our news losses through more profitable entertainment programming, but this is no longer a feasible strategy. So the angle going there is that the rest of the broadcast content on TV just isn't paying the bills anymore, and as a result, news is going to take the hit on it. And if that's the case, fine, we can accept that and we can work around that and realize that at some point there's going to be a decision that needs to be made. And whether that decision means splitting off the entertainment portions of the company into something that can be more profitable, something that could be marketed as a streaming service perhaps, and letting news work on its own and finding a market for the news that can actually make money, which of course independent media has to do each and every day. This is a story that is going to have huge ramifications going forward with the path that our current government is on. And the reason for that is something called Bill C-11. And we've talked about Bill C-11 before. It's unofficially known as the Online Streaming Act. And what it seeks to do is it aims to regulate what websites like YouTube and TikTok and so other social media companies, Facebook, Twitter, and whatnot, would show in their algorithms on their home feed. And the idea behind this is that the government wants these websites to be able to ensure that a certain amount of Canadian content is presented to people who are browsing these websites. And of course, YouTube and Facebook and whatnot have all already stood up and told the Canadian government that no, this is not how YouTube and whatnot works. And we could go down a whole rabbit hole discussing C-11, and anybody who's watched videos on YouTube in Canada recently will know that there's actually adverts on top of your YouTube video where YouTube is explaining what's going on with this and what the government is doing. But this misses the whole point that C-11 is only going to exacerbate these problems with the news media receiving funding from the government potentially on this, because news agencies like Global in particular end up publishing on YouTube and social media. And with that, there's a very clear conflict of interest in that they're probably seeing what's happening with C-11 and that they're thinking, oh, if a certain amount of Canadian content from known Canadian producers is going to be highlighted, that can be our content. That can get it in front of more eyes. That can get us more ad clicks. That can get us more likes, and that can make us more money. When in reality, at the end of the day, that's not the recipe for a healthy media landscape. And we need to be very clear that this is not something that popped up in the news media this week. Journalists on their whole are doing the best job that they believe they can. Emphasis on they believe that they can. A lot of them don't have the breadth of knowledge and experience from other fields outside of journalism, and it shows. But one of the main problems comes from their producers and their organizations that set the angle on what they cover. And what this means is that while it might be easy for online people to pick and target individual journalists as being part of the problem, there's a larger problem with the Canadian media establishment and the entities that they are. The government, if they grant this request, will be putting a huge weight on independent media to provide that independent reporting in our country to get through those algorithms, to get through that extra layer of government funding. And the reason this is so important, in particular with Bill C-11, is that Canadian content, in particular the news that you see each and every day that's produced in Canada by Canadian news organizations, would be favored when you go to YouTube, when you look at Twitter, when you look at Facebook. And as a result of that, independent media would be pushed further down. And YouTube, as I mentioned, has themselves have written to the government of Canada and gone as far as even appealing directly to Canadians to try and raise the awareness of the problems that C-11 has. The previous incarnation of C-11 was stopped in the last parliament and died before the election, but it's looking like this one is going to end up being passed. So with that, you combine Bill C-11 with more government money for the media. This only means that independent media will further be stifled. And the whole reason we're here and we do Western context is because there are these stories that the media misses. And if the media becomes even more of an echo chamber, that's going to be a bigger problem. And we need to be clear, we don't believe that independent media will be stifled because the establishment media will get their marching orders from the government and get funded in kind. We believe this is an issue because there is no way to compete with a government-driven algorithm and government money being funneled directly to news agencies. And of course, the media won't talk about this unless it raises controversy. And that's also the main goal of their business these days. And as a result, that's very likely why you haven't heard about this story and why it's here on Western Context.
Yes, this story being completely uncovered by the mainstream media is, of course, par for the course, because the mainstream media conglomerates in Canada are owned by very few select companies, one of which is, of course, Corus Entertainment, which is the parent company of Global News, and many others, of course. And so they're obviously not going to talk about the fact that they're trying to get more money from the Canadian government and that they're seeking more ability to control what people see. And Bill C-11 is just going to help our biggest media conglomerates out on this, especially when it's going to be pushing more and more Canadian mainstream news that isn't going to be talking about all of the other news sources that are coming about. And the only reason why we know about this story is because of more independent media from the mainstream. And we only really know a lot of what's happening with Bill C-11 because of outside sources from the mainstream. And I think that's why it's so important to look at all different variety of sources and make sure to fact check and look and make sure you get the whole story and what the bigger picture is of what's actually going on. Because if you only go to Global News, you'll of course never hear anything about this because they're not going to report on their own dealings in such a way. And no other mainstream media outlet is going to do the same because a lot of the time they're only doing the same thing. And I think that's it's interesting because it really shows just how singular the media is in Canada. And it just goes to show that issues like this are things that many Canadians are not going to hear about simply because of the fact that they're not getting reported on.
Yeah, and of course, that's a major problem. And we always remark about where we're at the end of the year, if the media has got better, media has got worse. And since we started the podcast, we can definitely say that things have got worse in the Canadian media landscape, and this would only push that problem even further. But we're going to head on now into a very, very, very traditional Western Context firing line.
Yes, and it should be noted that amid all of the news in the media about Kanye West's meltdown and blatant anti-Semitism, which you may have heard of course, if you've opened any internet site or any news site that's been talking about it these days, it should be noted that we at Western Context condemn and have stood on record in the past as having condemned all forms of anti-Semitism. And it's important to note that less blatant forms of anti-Semitism than what Kanye West has been doing recently do exist, and they exist in Canada. Now, an event was held on Tuesday called the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian People, and this was hosted in Toronto by Toronto area Liberal MP Salma Zahid, who is the chair of the Canada-Palestine Parliamentary Friendship Group. Now, MPs photographed at the event include Green Party leader Elizabeth May, Liberal Transport Minister Omar Al-Gabra, as well as Liberal MP Samir Zuberi, and this also included NDP MPs Nikki Ashton, Blake Desjarlais, Lindsay Matheson, and Matthew Green, as well as Bloc MPs Dennis Trudeau and Mario Beaulieu. Conservative MP Larry Brock said that he also attended the event. Now, also invited to the event was Nazee Kataba, who is a publisher at Meshwar Media. Now, his newspaper, Al Meshwar, is an Arabic language newspaper that has a history of publishing anti-Semitic and anti-Israel articles and opinion pieces, including celebrating last week's Jerusalem bombing attack that killed 16-year-old Canadian-Israeli Aryeh Shupak. Now, in November of 2017, an article published in the Al Meshwar paper claimed that the Holocaust was a Jewish plot and claimed that banks associated with the, quote, Zionist movement funded Adolf Hitler's rise to power in the 1930s. Yes, the megalomaniac who was trying to exterminate Jews from Europe. Apparently, according to this newspaper, was bankrolled by the same people that he was looking to commit genocide on. Now, a 2014 story published by the Canadian Jewish News documented an Al Meshwar newspaper editorial describing a Jewish Jerusalem synagogue massacre as being, quote, courageous and qualitative. Now, another editorial published in the newspaper, but not written by Kataba, referred to the Holocaust as the Holla hoax. Now, a story posted in Arabic to Meshwar's media website on Wednesday described this pro-Palestine event that many MPs attended under the headline, quote, "Representatives in the Canadian Parliament stand in solidarity with Palestine and call on the government of Canada to support the Palestinian people." Now, in the story, it reads, quote, "The speakers at the ceremony, including deputies and representatives of the associations and civil organizations, affirmed their solidarity with Palestine and their condemnation of the killings that Palestinians are subjected to at the hands of occupation forces and settlers. Member of Parliament Nikki Ashton said that Canada can play a better role for peace in the Middle East and is keen on human rights in the world, especially for the Palestinians." Now, Ashton's previous history with Kataba includes her public disavowment of his endorsement during her 2017 NDP leadership bid, where she issued statements stating that she, quote, "in no way supports his views and does not accept support from people who hold such views." Now, a photo of Ashton and Kataba taken at a 2017 fundraiser in Mississauga, Ontario, hosted by the Palestine AIDS Society, was used in online and in print endorsements for her leadership bid, including on the front page of Kataba's newspaper. Now, in his statement in response to all this, Kataba said that his newspaper is, quote, "not anti-Semitic, and we have never spoken badly about Jews in Canada or other countries. Rather, we criticize the Israeli occupation policy and stand by the Palestinian people." But the problem with this is that newspapers do, of course, have a record of what they print, and this means that you can only look through all of the anti-Semitic writings that the paper has been publishing. Now, in a statement, Liberal MP Salma Zahid said that invitations to the reception were circulated widely and that it was attended by nearly 150 people. The statement said, quote, "We are not able to research the history of every attendee that responded. As chair of the group, I will continue to be a voice for the human rights of the Palestinian people and for a just and fair two-state solution achieved at the negotiating table." Now, in a follow-up email, Zahid maintains that she has long been a voice against anti-Semitism and provided text of a statement that she delivered in the House 6 years ago denouncing anti-Semitic attacks. Now, Zahid's spokesman, Jeff Jadra, said that neither their office or the parliamentary group invited Catawba, but it added that, quote, "We will certainly review carefully how we handle future events with outside attendees." Now, a spokesperson from Transport Minister Omar Al-Gabra's office likewise denied any connection to Catawba. Now, Larry Brock, who is the Conservative MP that attended the event, said that he was invited by a constituent and said that if he had been aware of Catawba's attendance, then he wouldn't have gone. And he said, quote, "This individual has expressed their sickening and vile views publicly and made statements of support in response to the massacring of Jewish people and children. I fully condemn anti-Semitism and reject these disgusting views. They have no place in Canadian society." Now, a statement from the Green Party stated that May was not aware that Catawba was attending the event, saying that party leaders attend all sorts of events and seldom have control over attendees. Her statement reads, quote, "I wholeheartedly denounced anti-Semitism, but let me be clear once and for all, showing solidarity with Palestine isn't anti-Semitism, and neither is criticism of the state of Israel's human rights record. We denounce all forms of violence and show solidarity with civilian, Israeli, and Palestinian victims alike." Now, May made a bizarre speech at the event where she said, quote, "I take my marching orders from the permanent representative of Palestine to Canada." Now, marching orders is defined as being instructions from a superior officer for troops to move on their command. Now, for May to consider a foreign power who's superior and to consider following orders from a foreign power is reprehensible for a sitting MP, regardless of how inconsequential of a party the Green Party actually is. Now, it's odd how no one in the media other than the National Post has been talking about this story. Now, unlike the mainstream media, we at Western Context condemn anti-Semitism in any form, and we certainly do not take marching orders from anyone, let alone a foreign Middle Eastern pseudo-state.
And this story raised many, many eyebrows here, particularly both about what the heck winds up happening at some of these events, but also just what the heck is going on with the leader of the Green Party. And, you know, we watched the Green Party fall down in the last election campaign, and as a result of that, they chose to bring back Elizabeth May with a co-leader. And because of that, we're starting to see that, you know, she is, of course, a face that many people will know when it comes to the Green Party. But at the same time, there's just these very odd views that keep coming up. And with this, for any MPs that wind up attending these kind of parties, at this point in time, people have to know that you have to know who is hosting the event. And of course, there's a difference if you're at a big dinner or you're at a restaurant and some random person comes by and says hello and they sit at your table and they take a picture with you. Sure, that's different. But if you actually do decide to go to one of these events, that's an entirely different story in itself. And there's just so many unanswered questions with this, and this should be raising the eyebrows of the media this week here in our country, but it is not.
Yes, it's really odd how this story went completely uncovered, given the fact that it's included MPs from all different parties, not just the Liberals, not just the NDP, not just Elizabeth May, but all parties in Canada. And I think that that's something that should be mentioned, that all of these political parties were attending these events. And, you know, this is something that it really shows just how one-sided the mainstream media coverage is in Canada, when a story like this can be uncovered by any publication except for the National Post. And I think that that's, you know, it's bizarre to see not only Elizabeth May's speech, where she says that she's taking marching orders, but from the organizer herself, who said that they're not able to research the history of every attendee that responded to their invitations. Because if the invitations are going out, it means that they're wanting to have these people at their event. Obviously, if they're not wanting to see someone, they wouldn't have sent an invitation to them. Now, this is something that harkens to the Liberal government's controversy of hiring Laith Maroof a couple months back, who was, of course, the self-professed anti-racism speaker who ended up being an anti-Semite himself and ended up receiving about $600,000 over 7 years worth of government contracts just to speak out and professes hate. So quite clearly, the liberals who back then said that they were going to do better at researching the backgrounds of people now say they can't research the backgrounds of different people and that they can't control who shows up. And, you know, this is it just raises eyebrows again as to the contradictory statements that they said they would do better. And now they say they can't do better. So this is just on par for the Trudeau government for saying one thing, doing something else entirely, saying they won't do that thing and then do that thing once again. So the fact that the mainstream media didn't report on this and didn't talk about this story whatsoever is reprehensible.
Yeah, and of course, we'll have to wait and see if there's any sort of fallback from this. This could wind up being one of the stories on the year in review, since we are near the end of the year. But I think listeners who are very astute at this point will be able to take a guess at what our word of the week is this week.
Yes, our word of the week this week is marching orders, which, as I defined in our last story, is instructions from a superior officer for troops to move on their command. So certainly marching orders comes from a more military style doctrine than what should be in place for Canada's MPs. But it's interesting how marching orders came up a few times this week in the sense that the a lot of the media organization take their marching orders from the government, especially if they're wanting to keep their funding. And Elizabeth May apparently takes marching orders from Palestine, which is something that should scratch a lot of heads as well.
Yep. And this just, you know, as they say, the shoe fits, wear it, as we see with Elizabeth May, as we see with the media, and has been the case since 2017 here at Western Context. And all the episodes are archived at westerncontext.ca. Firing lines, full news stories, show notes, all that and more at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast on any number of podcast listeners out there. We're at westerncontext.ca/subscribe. We're on Apple Podcasts, Google Pocket Casts, Spotify, and more. Just visit westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And of course, we're also on Twitter and Facebook, where we share these shows and sometimes some of the stories that we're looking at throughout the entire week. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
Hey, we'll be sure to look through all the stories that the mainstream media talks about and a lot that they don't talk about in discussing what the news is of the week and how it pertains to Canadians and why it should matter to Canadians. Now, whether these stories appear in radio, TV, print, or online, we will find them and we will give you the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.